Didn't a couple of those guys have rebuttal times?
I think they used it.
Oh, they used it.
It's too short. All right, we're ready for the next case. Curious against International Development Group. Mr. Plotkin?
May it please the court. First of all, I hate to have to start my remarks with an apology, but I better do it. I think I have a misleading statement in my briefs that defendants never raised the issue of reasonableness of reliance. In fact, they did, but not in the motion that was granted. It was the motion for summary judgment. They raised it, rather, in a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And I should have pointed that out. And I think the way I have it is an absolute statement in my brief that they never raised it at all.
All right.
Your Honors, I'm going to assume that you've read our briefs as well as you have read the briefs in the preceding case, which seems exceedingly well. So I'm just going to get right to the issues. I have very little time. Judge Lindberg, who is a very fine judge, in our opinion, had no right to make the decision about reasonableness based entirely on length of time.
So let's go back to the survival statute. Because the way Judge Lindberg construed that, which happens to be consistent with the way some other courts have construed it, is essentially to say that when a claim moves from an individual to, from a corporation that's been wound up to an individual, the 5-year period of time to sue on that applies from the Illinois survival statute, because otherwise you really wouldn't have a survival statute. Corporations would wind up, the claims would move over to the shareholders, and suddenly you'd be there, you know, with 10 years to sue in a contract. And that's not a very attractive outcome. There are some claims that shareholders actually have, and other claims that are derivative of corporate claims. But to respect the Illinois law, why don't we need to say this particular claim is a 5-year claim?
Well, Your Honor, as we pointed out in the brief, we felt that Judge Lindberg, in relying on the Weiss decision, which was cited by Judge Shader, made a mistake. The Weiss decision was wrong, and Judge Lindberg's decision, I'd say respectively, was wrong for this reason. The district judges have no right to reinterpret the statute of the state of Illinois. The legislature passed the statute the way it did, and under the statute, when the corporation dissolved, the claims went to the sole shareholder. But I would, if I might, and I'm not trying to get off of the track of your question, why should Mr. Sharif have to suffer the burdens and the losses stemming from that statute, even if Your Honor was correct, even if Judge Lindberg was correct?
Well, the reason, if Illinois has passed a statute with a 5-year repose period, after which a corporation that's dissolved is just done, it's finished, then we need to decide whether that really is closure after 5 years, or whether claims that pass by operation of law to shareholders actually don't have a 5-year time. It's a question of statutory construction of 12.80.
Well, but if you will, let me draw attention to a few words of Judge Shader's decision, which was the basis of Judge Lindberg's decision on this point. Judge Shader said at the beginning of the relevant quote that Illinois law may very well be that way. I think he said that the party arguing that may very well be correct in stating Illinois law. And then Judge Shader went on to change the whole thing.
But I wouldn't put it, I mean, I know Judge Shader said that, but sometimes people write things and on the way toward a resolution. There are, in fact, two Illinois laws that are relevant here. One is the law that governs the survival of corporate claims after a corporation has been, you know, the passage of the claim from the corporation to the shareholder. The other is this statute of repose. And it's necessary to reconcile those two state statutes into some coherent whole. And what I interpreted Judge Shader as saying in that first sentence that you just quoted is simply that, yes, you know, you can look on the surface of the survival statute alone, and it may look like, people get claims forever, but when you have to read everything together, the only thing that makes sense is imposing the same 5-year limit.
Well, I don't believe that's correct. And let me just go back.
And even if Judge Shader was wrong, why isn't that correct as a matter of position other courts have taken?
If I may, Your Honor, let me go back to what you said. Well, you know, Judge Shader may have written that, but no judges write something. I was Judge Shader's law partner for many years. And I can tell you, Judge Shader has never written a word in his life that he didn't mean and consider.
And when he said that
may well be correct, that may well be correct, he then went on to construe the statute in a way that's contrary to its wording. But may I ask?
And just may I ask that you're in your rebuttal time. You may use it as right now if you want, but this is.
Well, I'll just use 1 minute. Good. Why don't we invoke here the doctrine that's recognized in the federal courts? And that is that we're going to ignore the corporate form where it creates an injustice. Remember here, this was a pharmacist who was asked to incorporate to do this work for the Saudis. And the Saudis made millions and millions of dollars from it and then decided they weren't going to pay him anything. Why don't we just say, we're going to ignore the corporate form in this situation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure. Mr. Shahn?
Your Honor, my name is Lawrence W. Shad. I represent a corporation. I am the defendant in this action. It is a pleasure to be before this court and appear before this panel. Your Honor, let me immediately turn to the question of the survival statute. In Canadian Ace, the Seventh Circuit held that the survival statute is just that. It bars all issues of collateral estoppel. It bars all issues of tolling. It is the survival statute. It is not a statute of limitations. Furthermore, in Canadian Ace, the court there held that the survival statute adopted by the state of Illinois, and at that time, Your Honor, it was only a 2-year survival statute. Now it's a 5-year statute, and I think that's a point that this court should reflect upon. Before it was 2 years, you had to get under 2 years, now it's 5 years. There's this considerable greater period there. But that court held that a survival statute, one could not bring an action belonging to a corporation because it was a derivative in nature unless it was sued on in 5 years. The cases that follow that decision are totally consistent with one another, Your Honor. Let's first go to Judge Shader's opinion, if we might, in which he made the observation, well, all property generally passes to a shareholder. But if that was on its face all there was, there would be no basis for survival action. And indeed, the Judge Shader's opinion toward the end said, well, indeed, even the type of cases discussed in the exceptions, Shute, Lake County Trust, and Dubie, as coming outside the constraints of 1280, those being promissory notes and lease security deposits, are the type that come out. And the reason
why isn't this letter of August 1st, 1992, at least, something in the nature of a promissory note? The letter, which is at page 26 of the appellant's appendix, has a very specific amount of money. We're going to pay you $800,000. It's been approved. We're going to give it to you. Why isn't that amount, at least, forget about this $2.3 billion or whatever we're dealing with, but why isn't that exempt from this rule?
I'd be glad to argue that. The rule, though, Your Honor, is, as enunciated by the courts, is it must be a fixed debt
Right, $800,000.
A debt and a fixed amount of money. Well, first of all, Your Honor, that is a position never adopted by the plaintiffs. They simply say that is an agreement that goes back to the June 1st, 1988 agreement. They have never taken that position before this court. They have always said this is an agreement which somehow continues the life of the June 1st, 1988 agreement.
So you're why thinking you, that this, you know, they've, since
and,
they went on
several
judgment, that they've, I just want to get your position clear,
that
they have waived the right to rely either on a promissory note theory for this August 1st letter or an independent contract theory?
Yes, Your Honor, and I have a couple other points on that, too.
All right.
One thing in which, when you read the cases on 1280, they talk about a fixed debt because they say it has to be fixed, it has to be established, we have to know the amount. If we take this agreement that was signed in 1992 and take a look at it, Your Honor, it does contain obligations set forth therein for the plaintiff to perform. If you look at it, you say as a result, the contract has been extended for 3 years with a subsequent three-year option period. So if you're going to extend the contract, it's going to relate back, according to their position, to the June 1st, 1980 agreement, which imposed certain obligations and responsibilities upon the plaintiff.
Why don't we have a factual issue, though, as to whether those were performed? I realize it's your position that nothing ever happened, that it was other companies, that indeed there was fraud, which is...
it's a very interesting
fraud at the beginning, but why isn't this at least a concession that whatever he was supposed to do under the 1988 agreement had been done in the amount of, you know, such that he had earned $800,000 as of August 92?
Well, Your Honor, I think that document has never been espoused to be a promissory note. Never been proposed to be a promissory note by the plaintiff. I think it contains certain obligations that makes it a continuation that we assume with a contract of June 1st, 1988. If we go back to June 10th, 1988, pardon me for misspeaking, if we go back to the June 10th, 1988 agreement, plaintiff himself has filed an affidavit in which he said that that agreement, which he participated on, he was advised at the time that agreement was implemented with the Indianapolis company that we referred to as BAMI, that it was a nullity. That, according to him, my defendant said, we're not even going to honor that contract. And he said, oh, gee, where does that leave me? And he immediately, the only question he had was, well, am I going to get paid? That's the only question he had. He never went
back. Why would he rationally have wondered about that, at least for the 800, as of, you know, August 2nd, 1992?
Well, let's assume for a moment, Your Honor, that is... Let's just assume for purposes of argument.
No, I realize you dispute the authenticity of the document and so on and so forth, but I'm just trying to explore whether there is anything that needs a trial in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I think that when you look at that, it's clearly not a note because it relates back to the earlier agreement and it sets forth, for purposes of argumentation, a contract extension. So therefore, it is not a note, and if the $800,000 is due pursuant to a contract extension, you have to go back to the first contract to ensure that it is due under that contract. And finally, I would say to Your Honor that this is also interesting because this was entered 1992. It was entered 2 years before the corporation dissolved, and it was entered approximately 10 years before this lawsuit was filed. So you have to ask yourself, how could this be viewed as a note? There was no correspondence on the record anywhere that anyone treated this as a note. And I think that might be a question to be asked, but when you look at the interpretation on this, clearly I think it relates back to a contract. It has provisions that the plaintiff must perform. The other thing I wanted to mention, Your Honor, is in the cases discussing survival action, there is almost a total emphasis on the idea that it is a fixed obligation. It is a debt with a fixed obligation to pay. And as Judge Shader said, well, you know, the exceptions we have to the Corporate Survival Act, which he brought out in the cases, are notes and cash. The cash case was the Lake County case, I believe, dealing. Those are cases that are clearly distinguishable from this. And indeed, Your Honor, in the Doobie case, which was cited, in which dealing with the lease, with the security deposit, the court said a judgment which would be represented by a fixed debt and would be evidenced by a document would be similar to a transfer of tangible property upon which an action can be maintained. So I think when we're talking about something being a note for purposes of 1280, it's got to be almost akin to a judgment. There can be no question on what you're seeking to collect, and that's clearly not the case here. I'm not sure how much more time I have.
You have more than a minute, because the yellow light will be on when
you're... Oh, okay, fine. Thank you, Your Honor. But I did want to point out that this is a contract that plaintiff sues was not one between him, but one between his corporation and the defendants.
Now, your opponent raises a variety of kind of equitable defenses, I'll call them, to the application of this statute, including that we ought to pierce the corporate veil in this instance, and his corporate veil, I guess, and we ought to recognize some form of wrongdoing.
Well, Your Honor, let me simply end that the root of the plaintiff's problem here with his corporation was under his sole control. He alone controlled this corporation. He alone could determine when it was subject to be dissolved. He alone caused...
I thought it was an involuntary dissolution, though. I don't think...
Well, Your Honor, that's caused by a failure to do something. That's caused by a failure of corporate officers to pay their franchise tax. This isn't something that comes down from Thor. You get a notice from the state of Illinois, pay your franchise tax, and then you have a period of time, 5 years, in which to cure it. Your Honor, the sole problem here with plaintiff's argument is that he alone was responsible for his delay. He alone was responsible for dissolving his corporation. He alone was responsible for being, unfortunately, too late to bring this lawsuit as a matter of law. Thank you very much for your courtesy.
Thank you. How much time do you have? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Plotkin.
Your Honor, why should he have wanted to continue with the corporation? He's a pharmacist. The only reason that he formed a corporation, as I pointed out earlier, was that the Saudis told him that's the only way he could do business there. So why should he continue it? But the point here is...
Well, maybe he should have sought legal advice before he decided not to pay the fee, because it cut the statute of limitations in half.
Your Honor, let me just say this. I haven't gotten smarter from practicing law for over 50 years, but I have learned one thing, and that is judges always assume a tremendous degree of legal understanding on the part of the public that doesn't exist. The fact is, he was a pharmacist, and they were princes, heads of corporations, and all that. And the undenied fact is that they made hundreds of millions of dollars from the arrangement that he helped them establish. He was the one who got the American company to work with them. Now, it's true, they used the American company as a front, just a facade. But that wasn't his fault. They didn't tell him that until after he had made the arrangement.
But that is an odd part of your argument, because even though I'll accept that it wasn't his fault, the profits that he wants to be entitled to are those earned as a result of this manipulation.
Well, who should have them? Who is the one who is really the criminal here?
Why is
it the Saudis? If at some point, we have to say, here are two parties. This is a party that is sitting with the hundreds of millions of dollars, and they are the crooks. And
why isn't it a remedy in Saudi Arabia? I realize you're going to say something practical, but we are not allowed to be fully practical on this. If somehow violations of Saudi law took place, they were required to have an American partner, and they turn around and do something else, why are we the right place?
Well, I suppose, Your Honor, that the best answer is that my client has developed a perhaps understandable attachment to his head. One of the defendants here, Prince Mohammed, is the son of the Minister of the Interior in Saudi Arabia. He's the chief policeman. Now, he might want to hire me to go to Saudi Arabia. I'm not going to go.
That's all right. I'm not asking you to go to Saudi Arabia. Okay. I'm just trying to figure out what we should do with this case.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.